Welcome to AIM's Connect podcast. My name is Amos Kennedy, and I'm from a wee country called Northern Ireland. I grew up in Kenya as my parents were missionaries there, and after I finished university here in the UK, I returned in 2019 for 1 year to Northern Kenya as a short-termer with AIM. In this episode, I chat with Eddie and Rachel Anderson, who serve the Gabra people in Northern Kenya. Welcome to the podcast, Eddie and Rachel. Why don't you start off by telling us a bit about yourselves and where you work?
Okay, well, we work in northern Kenya on the Ethiopian border, a place called Dukana, which is in just north of the Chalbi Desert. It's a very dry and rocky area. Working with the Gabra nomads, there's around 114,000 Gabra, according to the last survey, but they're mostly nomadic. They raise camels for a living, and Dukana is one of the watering points where a lot of the animals come to water. And there's been a substantial town built on that watering point, about 8,000 people when we first came here about 5 years ago, and it's been growing ever since. So we've been seeing it as a strategic point to reach the Gabra, who are traditionally shamanistic and Islamic in background.
So in layman's terms, we live about 6 hours drive from the closest paved road. So we do 6 hours from the closest paved road of two-track driving. We have no grocery stores in our town. We just have small, like walk-in style closet-sized grocery shopping, which includes just a few basics. That six-hour drive is how long it would take to get to a hospital for a real emergency. Any kind of surgery, that kind of thing, would have to happen at least that much of a drive away or an airplane ride. And in that town that's on the tarmac, you can find a grocery store that's about the size of a convenience store grocery store. So like medical wise, we're very remote. Conveniences, very remote. There's just not a lot of infrastructure here. And so the people struggle because of that. And even like the work that we do, everything's kind of planned around when will we be in a place where we can actually get commodities and bring them in order to do the work that we do.
Fantastic. So you want to tell everybody a bit about yourselves? Obviously, I know you, but if you want to tell everybody just a bit about yourselves personally, your background, I suppose. Eddie, I know you grew up in Kenya, and then Rachel, and how you guys came to meet, and then how you both sort of journeyed together into mission and ended up in Dukana, where you are today. And I know this could be a very long story, but if you just want to give us a bit of a summary, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, it is a long story. I mean, there's a lot of components to it, but just a basic summary. I'm an MK. I was born and raised in Kenya. My parents had been working with the Samburu tribe. If that's about a 6 hour drive southwest of here, where we are now. We lived in a remote area as well, kind of like we are here, except for it was in mountains, whereas here we're on flatlands. But I got raised in the mission field. I went to boarding school. But always felt a call to missions. You know, I think one of those things when my parents were doing ministry, my dad would try to involve me in ways he could in his ministry. And also just when I came home from vacation, I was just always just struck by the way that my parents were reaching out to a very needy people and really changing lives, and just the change in lives of those who came to Christ as opposed to those who did not. And just the stark difference you saw. And I remember as a kid just saying, Lord, this is what I want to be. You know, I want to be able to be someone who changes the world and impacts people. And I saw that impact happening in the people of the Samburu. And of course, when I went off to college, I went and studied engineering first and then went on to Bible school. And that's actually where I met Rachel, was at Bible school.
Yeah, and I grew up in rural Michigan, so being in a remote location wasn't really anything new for me. Even our grocery runs were a bit of a drive away from us. You know, we had to live on a pretty strict budget. We couldn't just run out and get something from the shops. It just wasn't possible where I grew up in Michigan. As far as the call to missions, I grew up in a Christian home and went to a private Christian school. And I can actually remember very distinctly at my school, a missionary coming in and talking about his work, which was in Africa, as far as I can remember, and thinking, what a cool thing to be called to do. Man, if God would call me to that, that would be so amazing. So the concept of missions wasn't foreign to me. It wasn't a new thing, but it was definitely a long journey to get to the field.
Yeah, it did take us quite a while. We as a couple, we met in Bible school with a common vision. We both really felt a big call for missions. And I think that was what drew us together, really. That was one of the things in my, even in looking for a wife, I didn't want a wife who hadn't already had a call to missions. That was the first requisite, you know. There was no other look. So when Rachel and I met, of course, we started dating, and that I could see was on her heart. And I think because we had that share call to missions, we got married and found that we were well matched. Our first ministry, we took quite a while to get to the field. We looked at all different missions. We felt that AIM was the best fit for us for where we wanted to work. We prayed around the globe and felt Africa was where we were supposed to be, and then East Africa. We did our first stint in the island of Zanzibar.
Our first stint was short term.
You're right. Actually, I missed that one.
Yeah, our first trip was a short term trip in Tanzania. I was expecting our first baby. It was still like our first year of marriage. And so why not throw going into Africa on top of that into a second language that I didn't speak? And it was not an utter disaster, maybe close, but not quite. But it was a good experience in many ways for both of us, as far as finding out we could adjust together and we could cope with a lot of adversity together, and we could watch God provide for us in ways that we didn't expect.
Yeah. And so when we first went out as a full-time missionaries, we were first assigned to Zanzibar, and it became a different, of course, it was a ministry to Islamic people on the islands of Zanzibar, reaching out in unique ways through trades and such. And we just felt God was calling us into that ministry. But then about a year after being in Zanzibar, we ended up actually, AIM asked us to come to Kenya. There was a huge need in North Kenya for the Gabra people. And actually, when Rachel and I prayed about it, we really felt that's where God wanted us to be. And it was interesting, actually, as we came, I remember coming through Marsabit. We're getting, of course, in those days, there was no paved road to Marsabit. So it was all those rough hours going through the Isiolo Road in those days, very corrugated for, you know, 5 hours, 6 hours. And then we got to Marsabit. And I remember coming out of Marsabit, looking north at the desert. And then just my heart, it's like the Holy Spirit said, this is where you're supposed to be. Just looking at these just dead flats. And I remember having a friend in the car with me. I said, isn't this beautiful? And they're just like, are you nuts? But I think that with Rachel and I, when we got to the Gabra people, and we just felt that this was the people that really needed us. We saw people that needed Christ. So few had him. So few knew about him. And we felt so little work was being done amongst them. And even in their very, very remote state that they were in the very, very dry and arid land that they're in. I remember going to Galacha, and that was our first assignment in Gabra. And we got there, and they were having, like, I think 4 centimeters of rain per year, which is pretty staunch. And so people were desperate for water, desperate for grazing, and in that also desperate for hope.
That's an amazing story. I would like actually for you guys to tell the listeners a little bit more about the nitty gritty of that logistical story of you getting from Zanzibar to Kalachia. If you know what I'm hinting at, I think that's a really great story.
We're sitting in Zanzibar and we're supposed to move like in the next week. And our friends invite us over for dinner. So they introduce us to this guy who runs a ferry line from Zanzibar to the mainland. And he's like, oh, you're moving? Do you want help? We're like, why would you help us? He's like, you know, diehard Muslim guy, you know, committed, goes to mosque weekly or daily or whatever. And he offers his ferry for free of charge to move all of our worldly goods from the island onto the mainland, which is half of the battle. Then we have friends who come down from, they live not far from Kalacha, but they were down in Nairobi. They heard we wanted to move up and they're like, well, that sounds like fun. We'll help them move. I mean, who does that, right? So they came down to Dar es Salaam. Eddie went across with the ferry. No, you didn't even go with our stuff. Like, we put it on one ferry, which is an overnight ferry. And living in Zanzibar is a wild place already because everything goes by ferry. And even like the old dhows that they've been running for 2,000 years from the mainland to the island, they carry all their meat over on those. So if you can imagine, there are cow dhows that go every day full of cows. Well, our stuff went over on a ferry that was at least mechanized. So it had an engine.
Well, you know, I think the really funny thing is that, you know, the guy that offered to bring our stuff over, and we're like, okay, what do you want us to do with our stuff? So we're like trucking our stuff to the port. He's like, ah, just set it on the port over there. And we're just thinking, we're never going to see this stuff again.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering then, how did that stuff then, so it makes it onto mainland Tanzania, how then did it make it all the way up to Kalacha easily, or were there a few hitches there?
It mostly made it all the way to Kalacha. It was busted. But like Eddie, I ended up in Arusha, which is closer to the border of Tanzania and Kenya, and I stayed with some friends of ours there with the children, because we at that point had five children, and the oldest was only like 6 years old or 7 years old, right?
Wow.
So I ended up staying with friends, and then Eddie with our other friends, they drove it up in a Land Rover and a Land Cruiser. They brought most of it up, and then we twisted the arm of somebody else, and he brought another load up in another Land Rover. And then when we moved our family up, we just loaded that Land Rover again and brought everything up that time.
But I mean, one of the interesting things about that whole story is we wrap off Rachel. I go up to Kenya because I have to get a car, because I got to find a car. So I'm looking for a car. The only thing I can find is this old Land Rover. It's a V8, an old one, the only thing in our budget. So I buy the thing. And the first thing I do, I have to run all the way down to Dar es Salaam and pick up our stuff. And you think about that, that's like a 2-day drive all the way down to Dar es Salaam. We load it up. This other family that's helping us load up their truck. We load about most all of our stuff between the two trucks, and we head and do this trip straight up to Kalacha. Now, it's about 2 days across Tanzania, and then we're talking another 2 days across Kenya. And here we're going in this new car to me. First trip we go, and I break my engine mounts on the first go. But praise God, we're going on ECLO road, pounding like that. And we get in there and...
How's that road again, Eddie?
But praise God, you know, we stop. I look to the side of the road. There's a tire there that's torn up from a lorry, you know, just bits of rubber. But I'm able to take the rubber, form my own engine mount, cut it up, put it in there, tie it in. And we make the entire trip up there, drop off the luggage, go back down. I run down to Arusha and then pick up Rachel with the rest of our stuff. But anyway, yeah, so then... Of course, we go up as a family. So this is our first trip up. And we load up. We got Rachel and our kids. We've got our five kids at the time. Rachel's there. We loaded up with food for the next 3 months. We're loaded up with all the rest of our luggage. So the roof is just covered in stuff. Boxes, trunks from end to end of the Land Rover, piled up a couple times. We got the back stuffed up. The kids are all squished in the back seat and the front seats. And we head up. And everything seems to be going well until we get about halfway from Isiolo to Marsabit. So we're about 4 hours into our trip at the time. And then my radiator bursts. And so we're in the middle of the remote spot. And so I pull out there and I'm like, oh, shoot, what are we going to do? And I realized, OK, we happen to have a soldering kit under the seat. So I go out and I pull the radiator out and I'm starting to solder my radiator back together.
Oh, yeah. And he's working on the car. And I say, well, why don't I get the kids out of the car? We're in a really remote spot. You know, let me take them out at least over to where the bushes are and the trees are. And we can be in the shade rather than sitting in the car. And this guy comes up out of nowhere and he says, you shouldn't be here. This is dangerous. People get shot here all the time. I'm like, OK, great.
We're like, well, that wasn't actually a chance. And then a car comes by and he looks at me down there, you know, trying to mend my radiator. And he points out he's got this brand new Land Rover. He's like, what you doing with this old vehicle? You should contact your supporters and buy a new one. You know, they'll pay for it. And we're just like, thanks. Got this car. You
know? Yeah, it's all good in hindsight. That's great advice when you're broken down on the road.
Thanks for telling us how that works.
So we amend the radiator. I get it stuck in there. But then I realize after we left that spot that it actually what had happened is the head gasket had blown. And so we're just like putting every bit of water we have. We're going to puddles and filling the radiator. We're doing whatever we can to get up to Marsabit. And we actually don't make it quite to Marsabit. We end up sleeping in Logologo, which is at the base of Marsabit. But not knowing anyone, we go into where the church is. There is an AIC church there. We pull up there. The church is welcoming to us. They put us up for the night. And the next morning we find some water. We put it in the radiator and we take off and we make it with hardly any trouble all the way up to Marsabit. And so in my stupidity, I'm like, oh, wow, the car must have healed itself. So we went ahead and bought some water up in Marsabit. And we're just going to head off to Kalacha because now, you know, it's only at that period, it was probably about between a 4 and a 6 hour drive to Kalacha where we were working at the time. And so we loaded up in the morning at about, I think we left around 6 by the time we got to Marsabit around 7. And then we headed down towards Kalacha. Well, that was came like one of the worst rides ever.
Yeah.
We basically that before we even dropped the mountain.
It was 14 hours. What should have been like 4 hours was like 14.
It took us 14 hours. We were so dry. It was just miracle after miracle, though, that we actually made it. It was like we would scoot on like a kilometer or two and then the thing would overheat. We'd stop. We'd let it cool. We'd try to find water. We'd go another. And then basically we ran out of all the water we had in the car, everything we gassed. And then we just started doing, we'd start it and then we'd go a couple kilometers and wait and let it be like air cooled. Then we'd go a couple more until the battery died and we couldn't start it anymore because it could never charge up enough. And so here we are. Stranded in the middle of nowhere. Nobody's come to get us. And we've been on there for hours all day long. The kids are crying from water, you know, from being just thirsty and they're crying. And we're just like, what do? We're exhausted from getting in and out of the car, in and out of the car. And finally, you know, we get this tow from this lorry, this military truck comes along and we're like, can you at least give us a tow for a few kilometers? And they tow us up, you know, up a few kilometers and like, OK, we can't tow you anymore. And so they let us go. But by that point, we had gotten close enough to Kalacha. By the time the engine was cold enough, we were able to coast from there down into Kalacha. So we come into Kalacha. It's late at night, probably 10 o'clock or more. We pull in and there were some other missionaries there at the time. And they're like, oh, what took you so long? We're like, well, why don't you come and look for us? You knew that we left at 6 this morning.
You were just taking the scenic route. They were just, yeah, you're just letting your, take your time, enjoy the road.
I know, yeah. And they're just like, you guys decided to take your time and check on stuff and do a few fun things. So we didn't think anything of
it. Inspecting every rock.
All those cafes on the way.
I mean, when we got there, we were just exhausted. We were just dehydrated. Kids were crying. We come in, we drink some water from our, you know, from the missionaries there. We come out to the car. I go to the back to unload. And the back's empty. And the door had opened and all our food had fallen out.
Well, it wasn't just all of our food. It was not everything had fallen out. But what had fallen out was like this big bucket of all of our really nice food stashed away and it was all gone. Eddie went to go look for it and he found like the remains of it scattered hither and yon over the rocky plains.
But what had happened is like it had opened and it not just our food had disappeared, but my briefcase with all our cash for the next 6 months, all of my phone and the kids' clothes. And so we got in there and Rachel's setting up what she can with what's left. And I head out to go back down the road. And all we can find when we run into people is just places where there's just pieces of stuff. We found where the stuff must have fallen out, but there was no bag. There was no bags. There was no clothes. All there are is scraps on the ground. And so we come back and we start inquiring of every truck that might have gone over that road. And they're like, well, there was a military truck that passed through this way. Maybe you need to call them. So the next morning, I take off with one of the missionaries there. We go up to find a military base where we can call over radio. We call over and we find out where the base was, where this truck was going. We contact there and they're like, well, you know, maybe we saw something. Maybe. And then find a little bit later, I'm like, well, can you maybe return whatever you can? And so they're like, OK, next time we come through. So about a week later, they come back through. The truck squeaks into the mission station. They throw off the bags. So the kids' clothes we got back and my briefcase we got back. Of course, all the money was gone. All the food was gone.
And my jewelry.
And the jewelry. But at least we had clothes.
But it was pretty.
At least we had clothes back.
Somebody was wearing it on that military truck.
You know that. You know, somebody's girlfriend was really happy.
But the other thing we saw where the Lord really helped us, you know, that was really kind of depressing. It was a hard start. But the thing that I found, though, that I think was really neat is that, you know, AIM had found out, the office had found out about our issue, you know, that the door had opened. We lost our food. We lost our money. And the mission had taken up an offering for us. And they sent that money up to us so that we could have something to buy food with. And it was really what got us through the next couple months. They'd come together as a community and supplied that food for us.
That was amazing. Yeah, God provides.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I really love that story. I think it's just like, it just really epitomizes like you're not even there yet. You know, you're not even properly in your location and just all this stuff happens on the journey. And then you get there and you think you're finally there. And no, just everything is just the rug is taken from under you. I think it's just like the perfect like epitome of missionary journeys and those long dusty safaris where you just want to get there and you're just being prevented. Great story. Great story. Obviously not great for you at the time, but good to look back and see how God had provided for you in that situation and your young kids as well. So yeah, obviously you made it to Kalacha. When was that? About 2000 and was that about 2007? Am I right?
2008.
And then, so if you want to tell us a bit more about what those years in Kalacha looked like, how you kind of got to where you are today in Dukana. So how did that move into kind of looking forward to moving up to Dukana, and how did that all happen? What was your vision behind moving even further north and even into a more remote location than you were before?
So we'd always discussed going to the mission field, starting a new spot. That had always been on our minds, was to be in a new location where there weren't other missionaries working. When we came to Kalacha, there was actually a Timo team there, and we found ourselves doing a lot of just support for the team as far as keeping their vehicles on the road, a lot of emotional support, sitting down and having cups of coffee with the single young ladies on the team. And so we got them through, helped get them through for their year and a half that they were finishing up. And then we continued on in Kalacha after they left, which was not what was expected when we went up. Our office fully expected us to be the ones moving on and somebody from the Timo team staying, but that's not how God worked it out. It worked out that we stayed there. So after our first term, we did 3 years, our first term, and then came back out kind of thinking we'd start looking for another place to do outreach. We weren't absolutely certain that it would continue to be among the Gabra, but that was certainly a serious consideration. And so we looked at one town on the border called Sabare, which would have been more of a mixed tribal ministry, but on consulting with wiser minds than our own, we decided not to do that because there are often shootings and violence there because of the mix of the tribes. And so then Eddie just discussed with the elders of the church and started looking at different Gabra locations, and Dukana came to the forefront. And so when he presented that to the church, the elders were not too keen to go to Dukana themselves, but they said that they would support us in moving. So at the end of our second term, the last year of that was spent building Dukana so that we could move our family up.
But I mean, some of the story behind that too is pretty amazing. Like, we had done some vision trips and stuff to look and see what the need was for the gospel. But what we saw right before we moved, our first couple of years alone after the Timo team left were pretty dry as the church was trying to find itself after the loss of the missionaries and stuff. But then we saw what happened as they started getting a vision for outreach amongst their people. And some of that came through doing songwriting, you know, in the indigenous, you know, ethnomusicology, but they found that they could start sharing the gospel. And what they started doing was starting to strategize, how do we reach the Gabra? How do we get to all these different places? And that's where we had the discussion about where do we go next? And it was a matter of, they had all these places they wanted to share the gospel. But as we looked at all of them, it looked like Dukana was going to be the most strategic as the next move for a big move. And then, as Rachel said, when we brought it to the elders and talked about it, okay, how are we going to do this? They're like, well, obviously someone has to go there. And so we said, well, who's going to go? And pretty much the elders said, well, if you go, we'll go with you. And so there was that picture. And so we felt that as a confirmation. And we did the logistics. We put in the first entry into Dukana as we helped them get water. We asked what their greatest need was. And they said, we just don't have clean water to drink. They had hand dug wells, but there's contamination and there was lots of disease and such. And by helping cap one of their best wells and bringing water into the town, they welcomed us and they said, would you guys please come here and minister to us? And so that became our inroad as we first looked at coming into Dukana, with an invitation actually from the community, because they saw as we helped them bring water, drinking water into their village, and that we did everything hand in hand with them. You know, like when we put it in, we worked side by side with the people of the place, and I was in the ditches with them, and I was helping them learn how to do wiring and everything else. And we'd pray with them and stuff. And they said, whatever this is you have, we want it. You guys you're not like these other people that come in. Like you, other people come in, they send a crew, they do something, but you're in here with us. You're praying with us. You're working with us. And why are you doing it? You know, and we said, well, it's because of Christ, and we want to bring Christ to you. And they said, well, then come, you know, please come. And so they actually gave us a plot of land. They said, come.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a great story as well. You guys are just full of so many great stories and how, I guess your lives are a testament to, or at least that's what I saw anyway, whenever I was there, that just, you know, taking a leap of faith into the next thing, whatever it is, whether it's moving yourselves and your young kids all the way from Zanzibar up to Kalachi to serve the Lord in a very dry area, to then moving even further north to Dukana, where it's still very dry and even more rocky. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing testimony. So I guess for those of us that haven't been, what does a typical day in Dukana look like on the mission station for you guys?
Well, it's different for both of us. For me, it depends on the day of the week. If it's a clinic day for me, I work as a midwife down at the clinic. Then on those days, I get up and get down to the clinic, and I'm there for about 4 hours, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter. And I can see anywhere from like one or two women to the other day I had like 6 prenatals or antenatals, 2 postpartums, and a couple of well woman visits, just women who have health problems that wanted to be seen. And then after that, come home, make lunch, and then homeschool our son, and then go up to my garden and do some weeding up there. I also am teaching somebody literacy right now and doing a Bible study with a lady. So that would be a clinic day. On non-clinic days, I homeschool more in the morning so that our son doesn't, you know, completely fall behind in school. But then still do the literacy class and Bible study, and often end up spending a little bit of time in the garden as well almost every day. For Eddie, it's different.
Yeah, mine's quite a bit different. I mean, we kind of live in the same house and we sleep in the same place, but our ministries tend to be quite divergent in a sense.
We start and end in the same place.
Yeah, basically my day starts, you know, we have a good family breakfast. And then I head out to the workshop where we have a Bible study. And it's basically every morning we do a Bible study and everyone is welcome. But most of the time it's the staff that come to the study and then a few people that might be inquiring. And we do a Bible study. It lasts us probably between a half an hour and an hour. After that, then we basically organize the workshop. We have a mechanic shop. We try to get everyone organized, find out what work needs to be get done, people organized and put onto those jobs. Then, of course, we've been having almost constant construction since we came here. So then we have to organize the construction crew. So I usually go down, make sure they've got what they need, make sure they're organized, make sure that they have the next procedure set up. And then do an inventory of what materials we have, what we need to get, what needs for the garage. And then I'll go back and then I'll usually have a meeting also with our radio staff. Since we're running a radio station, then I'll have to sit with them, see how things are going. How is the broadcasting going? What things need to be changed? What needs to be addressed? Is there maintenance concerns? All those sort of things, you know, make sure their internet's working, whatever needs to happen. And then make sure everyone's going. Then I'll go back to my office, try to file the orders that need to be made. Prepare messages and things like that, and then.
But that's not every day.
But like, every day is a little bit different.
Could be like that. Yeah, it can be anything with any day. Or this water broke.
Or the water broke. Can you go to this town and fix their well? You know. Yeah. So I mean, every day is unique. It really depends. You know.
Sometimes somebody shows up and they need sutures.
Or someone
just name it.
Or someone just needs prayer. Or. You know, whatever.
Maybe your short termer develops appendicitis. You just never know what's going to happen.
Hey, that is another great story. Yeah, it's one that I love telling people here. Probably people that I know are probably sick of hearing, but for those that don't know, whenever I was there, it was probably about 6 months in, a nice warm January day. I had been teaching in the local school in the morning and I was kind of, I don't really feel too good. Came back up that afternoon and tried to eat lunch that Rachel had cooked for me. And normally, Rachel, your lunches were fantastic, but that day I just couldn't stomach it. So that showed how sick I was that I couldn't eat your food. and flown down to, wasn't it Kajabi? Yes.
Yeah, we flew down to Kajabi.
And sort of did a over the phone diagnosis, and a plane was there to get me in the next hour or two, and had the appendix removed that night. So that was good fun.
So you never know what our day is going to be
waking
like.
Waking up that morning, you just didn't know that was going to happen. So
and that's where you just see God's hand, you know, like even in your case of appendicitis, you know, while Rachel's talking to the doctor and diagnosing things, I'm talking to the pilots, you know, saying, is there any plane in the area? Who's on the ground? Who can move? And by the grace of God, the pilot's like, well, I'll start preparing the plane. You contact the office and tell them you're coming, you know, and by doing that, we were able to get the plane like 2 hours earlier than if we had done the proper channels. But anyway, it's one of those things where God just worked, you know, in amazing ways.
Yeah.
Things happen. And we just see that over and over again, you know, emergency after emergency pop up in this location, and then God gives a solution.
Yeah. Amen. That's definitely something that was evident the year that I was there, that even in the truth of the fact that every day is completely different, one thing you can be guaranteed on is that, you know, the Lord provides for whatever you do every day and gives you the strength to continue throughout each day. And I think, Eddie, what you said there a minute ago, just about how, you know, you might not know what happens after Bible study, but at least, you know, Bible study is going to happen in the morning. It was always good for me to know that was there in the morning, to be able to depend on that and to encourage that small group of guys that worked on the station for the rest of the day, and to hear from them and to be encouraged by them and their thoughts on the word or whatever passage we were going through that day. But just touching on that, do you want to tell us maybe a little bit more about sort of station life, in the sense that, you know, you have different people working for you and sort of who they are and what their different roles are?
Yeah, well, we have a variety of different people working. Like we have a radio station like our BHB Chalbi, which is reaching out in the indigenous languages of our region. So we're reaching out to the Gabra, the Burana, the Samburu, the Randile in their own language. And so to do that, we have a radio staff. Basically, we have three full-time staff at the moment. One name is Peter. He's a Samburu, and he does a great job of producing programs for the Samburu people. We have Mwambi, who's kind of our chief broadcaster. He's on loan from Nairobi, but he does an amazing job of coordinating and kind of overseeing the other guys that are local here, just giving him experience from his long experience in programming. And then we have another guy, Barako, and he is an indigenous Gabra, and his programming is basically to provide for the Burana and the Gabra communities that we're reaching. And so those are our radio staff. And then we have, of course, a mechanic staff. We have we'll talk about the first three. We have Doob, Doob, and Abdoob. Those are our evangelists. They're all very unique. We have our Abdoob, who basically goes out every morning on his motorcycle, and he's been assigned to reach different villages. We have like about 8 villages that have a weekly Bible study. And so basically he goes out and tries to cover one or two each day. And then Doob and Doob, the other two Doobs, each take other villages. And of course, Doob himself does a couple of, they've each been assigned to different villages, and they try to go out and then do the Bible studies with them. But the days that Doob, since they're also covered as our drivers and our mechanics, what they'll do is they'll take turns in the workshop doing mechanics on the day that they're not doing outreach. So basically, one will be in the workshop, the other one outreaches, and then they swap. The other one goes out and does outreach, the other one, and then he goes into the workshop. And then we have two other guys helping in the workshop, a guy by the name of Roba, who helps us with the bookkeeping, and then a guy by the name of Kusha, who's a local guy here, who we trained to do a lot of welding and stuff, and he's a pretty good welder and does pretty well in the motorcycles. But yeah, they stay pretty busy. We basically have a lot of business in our workshop. We have a little garage that basically started out under a tree, you know, out of necessity. And then slowly we've been getting shade over it, and we've added on. But some days we might have 5 to 6 cars. Other days it'll be 3 or 4 motorcycles. And some days we won't have anything at all. And in those days, it's just basically clean up the workshop and maybe look at different outreaches we can do that day. But those guys also cover a lot of other stuff. Like if there's a well down, I'll go out with those guys to go fix the well and do the repairs that need doing. Or if we're putting in a new well, they'll come with me and help me put in the new well. And then we also have basically a small construction crew, which is mostly run right now by a guy by the name of Denge, who's one of our neighbors, who's very active in our church. And he's one of our elders. And And he'll basically, if we have a new project going on, like we've done some extension to the radio, we've done a little bit of extension to the workshop, and basically he'll get a crew together of people from town that need help, and then he'll start building, and the other guys come to give him a hand. And so that's basically our crew there. And then we have a couple of women that help clean up the church. And also Rachel has a lady that helps her.
You guys have obviously local people working with you on the station, but you have other co-workers who maybe aren't there at the minute for the next few months. But maybe you want to tell us a little bit more about them.
Yeah, well, we've been blessed to have the Hardings with us. The Hardings, we'd been with them for a short time at Kalacha. They'd been on the Timo team. But by the grace of God, God brought them to join us here in Dukana about a year ago.
We've known the Hardings.
We've known them a long time. Like, I went to school with Steve. But they're an excellent couple. Like, Steve's a mechanic, an auto mechanic. And us trying to work a workshop here, it was trying to take over all my time. You know, like, even I didn't want it to be dragged out and dragged out. And it was just really neat to have God bring some people that had skills that we didn't, you know. And also our youth ministry was really struggling. What do we do with these little kids? And here's Angie with just a heart for kids, you know. And so they each came in and they had things that matched what we were doing, where our weakness was, they had strengths. And so like even with Steve in the workshop, it was so much a relief to me to be able to focus on radio and outreaches and stuff, and not spend all my days staring into engines and trying to figure out bad wiring. And it was just to me a huge relief. And also just to know that we didn't have to stress over a lot of our children's programming. That was just something that was on Angie's heart. And it's just like, that was just her natural outflow, you know? And also, I mean, Rachel could tell you more about some of the blessings with having them around.
Yeah, I mean, Steve and Angie are incredibly generous and just really, really love the Lord. And personality-wise, we just mesh really well. So it's like going to potluck and finding all of your favorite dishes lined up in a row and working alongside of them. It's pretty awesome. And we're very, very thankful. They're on home assignment currently, and we can't wait till they get back because we miss them a lot.
Yeah, you don't realize how much they've taken over and helped with until they're not there. And I think, you know, and God knows exactly who you need. You know, it was a long haul. We never even thought they'd make it here, but God brought them. And that was just a God thing. But yeah, they've been a very, very big benefit to the ministry. And again, the fit that we needed, you know, and I think that's how God works. He'll bring the right people for the right time. Like, even when you were with us, you know, it just opened up some ministries we couldn't do on our own. And we wish, you know, that God would bring it back, but it's like at that time, that's exactly what we needed.
And we have
God brings the right person at the right time for the right ministry.
And we have about 4 students from the secondary school coming to church regularly even now.
Yeah, praise God for that.
Yeah, we have a couple by the name of Darso Nasibo, and Darso's serving as station cook right now. And then Nasibo is primarily overseeing a young lady who just came to us about. She just moved here in January, but we started taking care of her basically in early December, the end of November. Tune, within the Gabra culture, if a young lady becomes pregnant and before she's married, she is automatically made an outcast. So traditionally, in the way not too far past, probably 30 years ago, she would have been taken out and stoned to death for this offense. Thankfully, some wiser minds came together and said, no, you don't need to stone them. They decided that since they couldn't stone them, they at least wanted to get rid of them. Dukana in particular used to be a town for getting rid of outcast girls. And Tune is one of these outcast girls. So she was brought here into town and left. And then when she had her baby, she went to Marsabit to give up the baby to an orphanage, to a children's home there. And then she was subsequently raped while in Marsabit, giving up this baby. And now she has another child. And when she came to us, her son is about 2.5 years old, and he was dying of starvation. She qualifies for famine relief, a nutrition famine relief program that's run by the Red Cross and the government of Kenya. But the people that she was staying with would basically take the food from her and eat the food. So she and her son weren't getting any of the food. So when they came to us, we sent them down, her and her son, down to Kajabi Hospital in order for the child to get some physical therapy. They took one look at him and said, we can't do anything with him until he's been admitted. He was admitted for about 2 weeks, I want to say, or a little longer, in order to get him up to a weight that was acceptable for him to be outside the hospital again. Yeah, he's much healthier and should become a very normal child eventually, but they still have a long ways to go. When they came back to Kana, there's just nowhere for them to go. They couldn't go to back to where they were living. That just wouldn't have been an acceptable solution, because he would have just ended up back to where he was, and probably worse off, because he was at a point where if they would have given him any sort of regular food, like even milk, it would have killed him. So we've taken them in here, and we're starting a program called Village of Hope to help other women in her situation.
Yeah, I think seeing her really opened up our eyes to what was going on. I mean, we'd heard about it through the grapevine that women were being, you know, abandoned. But, you know, finally seeing firsthand, of course, Tune, and now we've been introduced to like 60 others in the area that are in the same similar condition. Where there's a lot of these women that are starving to death, they're being abused and raped and just outcasted. And so we've really felt that we needed to bring a safe haven for them. And so we've decided we needed to start this, what we're calling a Village of Hope. So right now we just have our first person and then two staff that are helping to cover it. But we're praying that will grow more staff and be able to provide more refuge for more of these ladies.
And what's really cool about Tune is that today when we met for Bible study and literacy, because Tune doesn't read at all, like she can't even really write. Like she went to school maybe a year and then herded goats all of her life until she came here.
Wow.
So I'm trying to teach her to read. But then at the same time, she and myself and Nasibu, who's overseeing her, we do a short Bible study together. And Tune professed that Christ was in her heart today.
Awesome.
And was so excited to share that with us today. That's what it's so about.
Amazing news. And just so exciting to hear of those new opportunities and new ministries that are going on, particularly with the women, those that are sort of seen as outcasts within Gabra society. That's amazing. Just knowing how much you guys have going on, and we could talk about your different ministries, all of those that work alongside you and the amazing role that they play in the ministry to the Gabra around Dukana. I think one thing that I was really very impressed and encouraged by was the amount of young guys that were about my age in their early to late 20s. Whenever I went there, that are, as you already talked about, Eddie, that they're, you know, indigenous Gabra guys who have perhaps professed Christ for a long time and have grown up with some sort of recognition of the Bible. Then later, of course, they've come to know Christ and hold the Bible and hold scripture central, which was something I was very encouraged by. And I think it just really shows how God is truly moving and working among the Gabra. Thank you for tuning in to the first half of this conversation with the Andersons. Make sure to listen to part 2 to hear more from them on what God is doing among the Gabra.